when you work to cross cultural or ethnic lines, you were very aware that your work was contributing not only to the healing or the recovery of the individual that was in the consulting room with you, but that actually you were contributing to the healing of the body politic.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Today's guest is from a Scottish immigrant family to South Africa. He trained there as a clinical psychologist in Cape Town in the 1990s and worked in hospital services that embraced therapeutic community principles before moving to the UK in 1999. Within the UK, Gerard Drennan has worked in a variety of forensic services across London as well as in Sussex and trained as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. Within the UK forensic mental health world, Gerard has come to be closely associated with restorative justice principles. So we're really delighted to welcome you on today to talk about this, Gerard, but first perhaps if you could also let the listeners know what your job title is and your job role at the moment. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Naomi. My role is to be head of psychology and psychotherapy for what's called the Behavioural and Developmental Psychiatry Operations Directorate. But what that is a mixture of the forensic pathway, where I do my clinical work and have a lead psychology role, but then also services for ADHD, autism, and learning disability. So that's our sort of clinical academic group is how it started. It's a collective of services that cluster and really have quite a lot in common. But my main, where I get involved more clinically, is in the forensic pathway.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and welcome. And it's a real pleasure to be here with you today. We, of course, have met before, and indeed, we've worked together. We worked together for about 2 years or thereabouts in a very interesting project, which was both a pleasure and a pain. And the pleasure was working with great people like you and learning so many things within quite a short amount of time. But we both moved on since then. And Gerard, as we meet with you today, I'm aware that you have an enormously rich and varied background of experience and of training. Can you tell us about the journey that you've made to get to this point?
Yes, well, thanks for that. It's an opportunity for me to talk about South African roots. And obviously, there's my accent is the giveaway. I grew up in South Africa and came to psychology, I think, in a kind of roundabout route. Trained in South Africa at a very tense time socially and politically in the country. And psychology was very involved in that. There was psychologists who were very involved in resisting the government of the day and the apartheid regime. And so it was really fascinating to have a training in psychology that was sort of overtly and legitimately politicized in some way, that it was, you know, you were duty bound. And so when you worked as a clinician, especially when you worked across cultural or ethnic lines, you were very aware that your work was contributing not only to the healing or the recovery of the individual that was in the consulting room with you, but that actually you were contributing to the healing of the body politic. There was a sense that actually we weren't just our individuals, we also represented our communities, and a healing interaction contributed to that overall societal development. And that it's one of the things that I really miss working in the UK, that the social consciousness of the work that we do isn't that present. The work is described in much more technicist terms. And so I actually, in a way, it's partly how I've come to restorative justice, and one of the many reasons for why I feel passionate about the place of restorative justice in mental health work is that actually we aren't just, when we work with an individual patient, you aren't just working with that person, you're also working or thinking about their social network. And if that person has caused harm in a community, you're also perhaps being able to think about how might the community be repaired and not just the individual. But I realize I've gone on to restorative justice, and there was just something else that I wanted to say about the context of developing as a psychologist in South Africa, and that's the role of language. So it wasn't just along ethnicity lines that the country was split. It was also split along language lines, and even English and Afrikaans speaking communities at separate universities and separate schools, and didn't necessarily, weren't that integrated socially. And so I think that what that did was really alert me to how important language is in how people are enabled or disabled from being able to tell their stories and relate to each other. So I've really enjoyed the context of working, especially when you work in London. There's such diversity. There is often an opportunity for that kind of consciousness to still be in the work and to be part of how you think about how you are as a clinician.
It's really fascinating. And I think when you said that you'd been raised in South Africa, it kind of like, oh, that makes perfect sense then, this interest in restorative justice. But I wonder if you could say a little bit about restorative justice, so for the listeners, so that they're aware of what you're talking about.
Yes, sorry, I started to say about that and presumed that. So in a criminal justice context, restorative justice is a process by which someone who's been harmed, perhaps avoiding the term victim, and someone who has caused harm, and in that way, perhaps also avoiding the term offender, but having, again, perhaps a linguistic focus on that the reason that they are connected is because of the harm, rather than just the idea of an offence, which is somewhat so much more abstract. But restorative justice is a structured way in which someone who's harmed or caused harm could be in some sort of dialogue, some sort of communication about, not so much about the laws that have been broken and who should be punished, but about who's been harmed and whose obligations are, who is obliged to try to respond to the repair of that harm as far as possible. And so in criminal justice settings, in an ideal world, that will involve a face-to-face meeting that is prepared for in a particular way, and we can talk about that as we go on. But sometimes those contacts are also indirect, so they can be a letter exchange or a proxy representative who mediates and creates a dialogue. And increasingly, what we're finding is that those sorts of criminal justice applications of restorative justice can happen post-sentencing, but also before sentencing, and also increasingly magistrates are doing what's called restorative cautioning in order to try and build a repair function into the way in which a debt to society is repaid. But restorative principles are being applied in schools and in workplaces. And even in the UK, I can proudly boast having the first restorative city. I don't know if you've heard about restorative cities, but Hull was the first restorative city. And then Leeds went on to be the next, mainly through the leadership of the town, the council leader at the time, Nigel Richardson. So there are a growing number of restorative cities and restorative local authorities in the UK, including Brighton, Bristol, Guildford, all working towards this. But not only cities, also nation states. So there's this concept of transitional justice where, and this was illustrated in South Africa through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where if you simply prosecuted offences, so it would be very difficult. Some of the harm caused was actually state-sanctioned violence. So there may not necessarily be a legal route for prosecution, and that can simply create retribution. And so sometimes nation building is achieved by being able to encourage narratives between people who are on opposing sides, sometimes for ideologies that they believed in, and where if you're going to have a coming together, you need dialogue, not punishment. And so that's where we talk about a restorative spectrum, which is operationalized in a particular way in criminal justice settings.
I'm really interested in the kind of like thoughtfulness around the language. So the idea of the harm being referred to and that being and causing harm seems so much healthier than kind of calcifying in people's identity, victim and perpetrator, which seems a lot harder to grow and move on from, doesn't it, when that kind of language is used. I know both Hull and Leeds very, very well, and I'm wondering what happens in restorative cities.
So I think the way in which it began was with training people who work in the council, large numbers of people who work in the council in restorative principles. So they wouldn't necessarily be able to deliver restorative justice in a criminal justice setting, but being trained in restorative conflict resolution for people who work in housing or and people who work in education and in social care.
Yes.
So all of the way in which you communicate, in which community is built. And in fact, the council leader at the time, Nigel Richardson, they had objectives and principles, but then he described three obsessions. And the obsessions were all about children and the number of children in care, number of children missing school, and the number of children not in educational training as being the litmus test of the health of a community, and to really focus on the next generation and in a way helping adults to be better parental figures through different ways of thinking about conflict.
Yeah, it seems more kind of about bridge building rather than division and separation. So you're really interesting.
Yes.
So clearly your upbringing in South Africa has had a huge impact upon you. And talking with you now reminds me of talking with my friend Deborah James, who works at the LSE, who must have come over from South Africa at about the same time as you, and obviously very challenging times indeed. So, but since then, can you just bring us up to date on what you did when you got to this country?
I think I hadn't worked very much in forensic settings in the UK. My training had included that and some research, but not clinically so much. And I specifically wanted to work in forensic settings in the UK because I knew from the reading about clinical work here that it was a particular site at which issues of race and identity were at their most sharp, let's say, and also issues of migration and language difficulties. So it partly met my need to not disconnect from those roots and to try to bring something from my South African experience to that. But also though, because of being analytically orientated in my clinical work, it was a space in which there's more time allowed for clinical work. So if you're prepared to work long-term with someone who has got quite difficult and long-standing issues, and very often that's enabled in a way that in primary care in the UK, it's often not. And so I think it was those two things really that meant that I've found a home, as it were, in forensic services in London and for a period of time in Sussex as well.
And of course, you went on and trained as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist as well as a psychologist, didn't you?
Yes. And that really was in order to be able to support patients in their recovery better and to be better able to do that, but also to, as a leader in a psychology and psychotherapy service, to be better equipped to hold that work, to offer containment? Because, I mean, we, you know how from your work settings, how your patients or your prisoners' response to treatment depends upon the skill and the containment of the staff team. And so I suppose I want to, a training in order to be more able to support other people as well to do their job of containment of their patients better.
Yeah, yeah, thank you for that. You've also got me thinking about a comment you made just now about the political awareness in South Africa, which was, you know, something which was a necessity because of the highly charged social and political circumstances and the absence of that, relatively speaking. And I think I agree with you that mostly in the forensic field, we don't make great efforts to put forward our social and political thoughts. And indeed, there may be some fear and some anxiety about doing that at times, I think. But it does remind me of when I was secretary and committee member of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy, that they did take a very kind of politically sensitive interest in the world at large, really. But moving on, a couple of years ago, you gave a talk entitled Psychotherapeutic Change and Restorative Justice in Dialogue. So do you see these two approaches in conflict, or as being complementary?
Well, the short answer would be mainly complementary. And where that, in a way, the question came from, or the title, was in order to sort of foster a dialogue between psychotherapy communities and restorative justice communities, in order for us to be able to learn from each other. Because when I first did an initial training in as a restorative justice conference facilitator, which is a 4-day, tends to be around a 4-day training, with a very charismatic and inspiring trainer called Henry Kiernan, who still supports the restorative justice work in mental health very much. But I when doing the training, in a way, the process of restorative justice was a bit of a kind of a black box, you know, how on earth does this work? And then, of course, when you do the training, you see the mechanics and how it actually gets operationalized. But one of the first things that a restorative justice trainer will tell you is that restorative justice is not therapy. And it partly technically has to be not therapy, because it's often being done by people who are not trained as therapists. They might be retired police officers or probation officers or educational workers, teachers. And yet when you learn about restorative justice and how it's actually done, you realize that there is a very wide range of therapeutic skills that are being deployed in order to be able to do it. It's problem solving, it's systemic, it's cognitive behavioral, it's relational in so many ways. So there are a lot of therapeutic skills that are embedded in the process. And So I partly wanted to use that talk at the annual conference for the Restorative Justice Council to be a way of introducing therapeutic concepts to the restorative justice community, but also to talk about how restorative justice practitioners can help therapists think more about using restorative justice more. So the way in which they can be complementary is that when there's been harm caused, and that may not be harm that's been prosecuted, that, you know, there may not have been a formal offence that resulted from that, that there may be, I think that as therapists, we don't necessarily think about the possibility for an actual meeting between people who have been harmed, or a dialogue to take place. We tend to think that our consulting rooms have everything that they need, whereas in fact there's a potential moral authority that someone who's been harmed directly has with the person who's caused harm that is much more powerful than what therapy can provide, in the because that can at times be quite abstract. We ask patients who might have a limitation in their capacity for mentalization to actually imagine a complex emotional state in someone who's been harmed. And so one of the ways in which therapy can be dialogue with restorative justice is that it can help to prepare both harmed and harmer for that encounter, if we're aware of its existence as a possibility. And of course, it can then deepen that work by continuing reflection and consolidation. I mean, you'll know from your work in therapeutic communities that there is so much a process of working through, learning from incidents, that therapeutic work can then continue to deepen as people start to live what they may have learned through a single encounter.
So I think those are really good points, Gerard, and you're making me realise. I mean, the good thing about doing these conversations with people, for me, is that I'm constantly engaging about things that I haven't really thought properly about in my life. And I realise now that restorative justice is one of those. It's been a kind of not invisible, but transparent activity that I've known and been aware of, but didn't really take a great deal of notice of, even though my old governor at Grendon, Tim Newell, retired from the prison service and went away and started doing restorative justice projects. But I haven't really attended it to it very much.
You raise a really interesting point about the difference between therapy and what's therapeutic. And I think, you know, I get that in terms of what you're saying about restorative justice, but also even if you think about the role of prison officers within therapeutic communities or pathways, the offender personality disorder pathway services, that the people come into formal therapy sessions to try and figure some stuff out and make some headway in terms of what they need to be processing, but it's quite often the interactions that they have with the prison officers that prove the most meaningful in terms of enabling them to enact some kind of change in who they are. They're really thought-provoking.
Yes, and if I could just have a quick follow-up on that in relation to the therapy issue, because what you said about Naomi, it's not therapy but it's therapeutic, and we've had a similar conversation about in relation to trauma, and it's not a treatment for PTSD, but it alleviates trauma.
Yes, yes.
And actually the strongest evidence base for the application of restorative justice in criminal justice settings is for the benefit to victims, the people who have been either depressed or anxious or insecure and in some ways broadly traumatized, whether that's formal PTSD or a different type of trauma manifestation, that is the strongest evidence base. The evidence base for the reduction in offending is not as strong. And of course, because that's so multiply determined, it's not that it's weak, but it seems to double the effect of routine treatment. And yet within a forensic setting, we so often will say, well, should we use restorative justice? Will it help with reducing offending? And I've had to shift my focus to say, well, actually, whether it helps the offender or not is really secondary. There's a risk that you simply are exploiting the victim for the offender's rehabilitation. Actually, we need to have a very singular focus on attending to the victim's needs, knowing that if those are attended to well, there could well be a benefit for someone who's caused harm. So I suppose it just felt like the right moment, I hope, to just come in with that thought, because it's such a key discussion point, I suppose, in this whole notion of a dialogue between therapy and restorative interventions.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you're talking, it made me think of, we had very few people who'd been harmed wanting to engage with our population, but one of the conversations, you know, talking about their offences in groups is incredibly difficult for people to do when they've worked through 3 years. In the first 3 years of treatment with us, would be focused on becoming more emotionally rounded, so really getting to be able to connect with and feel things like fear and sadness and shame. And to then go and talk in a group about the worst thing you've ever done, obviously, is extremely painful. But we used to have conversations about how in some way they owed that to their victims. Their victims weren't present, obviously, but in some ways, if they were truly sorry and wanted to find a way forward, that they owed it to take, I guess, seeing it as a way of taking, really taking responsibility at quite a deep level, to be able to go and acknowledge that this is what happened. But and from that would then come pride at their courage for having been able to take that step and be able to take responsibility in such a full way. And I can only think that if someone who's been harmed wants to engage in that process, how powerful that dynamic must be for both of them.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It seems like restorative justice is an excellent example of how Western European countries have a lot to learn from other nations, rather than just kind of like flogging the same old Western European ideas. Do you think you'd have come to be interested in it if you hadn't spent time living in South Africa?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, possibly, because of course there are conflicts that are part of the UK as well, and restorative justice is a very powerful social and cultural motif, as it were, in Northern Ireland, where there's lots of work initiatives to address the harm within the society broadly, without taking a criminal, you know, approach to it, but I think that perhaps there is something about just being able to see the importance of dialogue in order to avoid social exclusion, and I think this is a really key theme, having seen the conversations you've had with other people in your podcast series, that I know you've given a lot of thought to the impact of social exclusion and being locked up for long periods of time. And I think what societies have that where they can't build their way out of a problem, they can't just build more prisons or lock up all of their young people who get into trouble. They have to find a way to bring young people back into society to try to say, how do we move forward from here? And I think it's that the commitment to not seeing banishment as a solution, that has been something that I think I've brought with me from a South African setting.
Okay, elsewhere, Gerard, you've written that forensic patients are burdened with the stigmatizing labels of contact with the criminal justice system and with mental health problems. And the same may be true of many people who are locked up in prisons, of course. Would you be suggesting that restorative justice can bring benefits to these people, and how would that be?
So it's always a bit anxiety provoking to be reminded about the things one said or written. Hope you can still stick to your principles, but actually this is one I'm really sticking to, because it's actually, this issue of stigmatizing is really fundamental to the restorative justice and restorative principles ethos. So when we've talked before, you know, about what it would mean if people meet, but people often come together for conflict. And so, for example, in a treatment environment in the therapeutic community, sometimes there is a process of telling off, as if that's in some way having a voice heard and in some way restorative. But actually the fundamental principle of two people coming together in a restorative way is that there is an advanced agreement that you will have this meeting, and that this meeting will be used to draw a line and to move on. So it's not just about blaming. It's not just about shaming, and in the literature that's called stigmatic shaming, when someone is supposed to only feel shamed. But the principle of restorative work is something that someone called Braithwaite wrote about, which is called reintegrative shaming. So there is an intention in the restorative encounter for emotional contact that may increase shame in the person who caused the harm, as they perhaps have a greater realization, you know, of what it is that they've done, a really powerful appreciation, a heartfelt maybe impact of the offense can come through. But the part of the ritual structure is that once that shame has been noticed and acknowledged, that then there is an agreement about how there can be restitution. How do you get permission to move on? And the person who's been harmed will say, well, our agreement will be if you can do X, Y, and Z, then we will move on from here. And so there is the possibility, I'm going to use a religious term, it's not intended religiously, but there is the possibility of a type of absolution that actually so many people have committed offenses aren't able to give themselves. They can't absolve. The only person with the moral authority to give absolution, or what's sometimes referred to as forgiveness, is the person who was harmed. But because of your preparation, you know that a form of absolution will be the outcome. And often at the end of these meetings, there's an intention that people stay and talk socially and perhaps we'll have a cup of tea and a biscuit together. So there is this intention of expressing a wish for the person who caused the harm, the offender, for their humanity to be acknowledged, and for that to reintegrate them back into their community, to give them some social capital to rejoin and feel as if they can once again have a stake in their social setting.
The powerfulness of that, and especially when you're talking, it reminded me of when we first opened, and there was obviously, with the nature of the population that we had, there was a lot of aggression, and when someone behaved with aggression, there would be officers at that point were wanting to take the person to segregation because they wanted to see a tangible consequence to the action. And we would talk about, well, actually having a conversation and talk about feeling disappointed or hurt that I've been bending over backwards to support you, and then you've sworn at me in this way or thrown something at me or what have you. And that is far more powerful, actually, than taking someone down to segregation, where I suppose as soon as they get removed under duress and potentially being taken down by a team who are all kitted up, so they feel quite frightened, they become the victim in that. So even though they're going to segregation because they've behaved aggressively, yes. Whereas actually to have a conversation where you talk about the emotional impact of how you've behaved towards me keeps them in the having to take responsibility for their actions rather than allowing them to forget about it and switch into this victim state. So really very, very powerful, I think.
Yes.
Yep. Go on, Tara.
Is it okay just to reply? Because you've sparked so many thoughts and links in my mind. Because, of course, what you're describing is a kind of a sadomasochistic enactment.
Yes.
And the difficulty is that sometimes the behavior is so powerful, so aggressive, that there is no alternative but for there to be consequences. There needs to be, or else you're in the, you know, sadomasochistic enactment continues anyway. And so there might need to be both and. But what you've reminded me of is that there are strong connections between restorative justice and the principles of nonviolent communication. And one of the principles of nonviolent communication is don't strike while the iron's hot, strike while the iron's cold. And so it might be that there does need to be a containment, physical containment in segregation, but then to create the space for reflection. And one of the ways in which restorative thinking has changed school practice in New Zealand is that the teacher stopped talking about the naughty step and started talking about the thinking step. An invitation to mentalize, you know, what has happened and why, and that's part of a process of reintegrating.
And again, just shows how powerful the language is, doesn't it? My colleague, Des McVeigh, would say to the officers, you know, as this person has to be removed to segregation, you need to be saying, you're going to the segregation because you've behaved in such a way that people were feeling frightened of you. And owning your own vulnerability enables to keep that shift, so that there's to keep that sense of the responsibility lies with the person who's behaved in the harmful way, even though they're having to be removed because they're too dangerous at that point in time, for instance. So yes. Yeah, absolutely.
If I can just come back to your answer a couple of minutes ago, Gerard, because I thought in your description you were beginning to describe a therapy, the therapeutic process, in inverted commas. And indeed, I've often had discussions with people about the impact of raising shame and whether that is traumatizing or re-traumatizing. But held to the idea that there's something that may possibly be worked through, and it's a delicate and careful process to do that. But I think you were also meaning something else, which was more like a kind of benign acceptance or a benign reconciliation, which isn't quite, as it were, working through to a kind of psychotherapeutic understanding or acceptance, a kind of change of the underlying internal relationship, but something slightly different from that. I don't know.
No, that's right. It is different. And the psychologists and psychotherapists who have done restorative training, conference training, we'd quickly have to learn that we have to not be therapists, to leave your therapy hat at the door when you do the work. And part of that is because your role is to facilitate the emotional contact between the two key people. It's not about you, it's about them. And actually the change process or the insight process comes from the dialogue between the two people with the greatest stake in what happened. And perhaps issues of gaze, because I think what you were saying about shame and the sensitivity of that it is there is about a gaze, and if it's possible to be seen as both someone who caused harm but someone who can be of value, that process becomes possible in this very concentrated and concertinaed encounter.
I think that takes us on to our next area, doesn't it, Naomi?
Listeners might wonder what a podcast focused on overcoming adversity in institutions is doing, talking to you about restorative justice. Well, I think that's to some degree symbolised in the Kintsugi workshops you've been involved in developing. And I suppose for anyone who's not familiar with Kintsugi, it's a Japanese concept whereby broken pottery is repaired with gold, and somehow that adds value. And I wonder whether you could say a bit more.
Yes, so thank you for as well. I really appreciate having an opportunity to talk about Kintsugi, because it's a recovery college course that we developed, and really want to acknowledge the work of the restorative justice practitioner who works in our project at SLAM, Finlay Wood, who has really run with this concept of Kintsugi and developed a really powerful six-session program. But where the concept came from was that we used the sycamore tree at River House in the medium secure unit, which I know a lot of prison listeners will be aware of, because sycamore tree has always been delivered within the prison estate before, but we had a rare opportunity to deliver it in the mental health setting for the first time. And we had fantastic engagement, but what we also found was that our patients sometimes needed a stepping stone towards sycamore tree, that they needed more preparation. And also that was often because they were more still focused on their own victimization, their own trauma, and not yet ready to think about the victimization of others. And so in order to do that, I was aware of the Kintsugi notion, and we developed this six-session recovery college course in co-production and co-delivery with a fantastic group of peers trained in the Recovery College model. And the structure of the program is the first week is obviously everyone signed up to it. They know what it is that they are contributing to them. The language also changes. They aren't patients, they're learners, as in Sycamore Tree. And the first week introduces them to the concept of kintsugi with video material and also the adult modeling clay that will be used to build their object. And then they're asked to think about what they might want to create to represent either themselves or some aspect of their journey. And then in the second week, they make the object that they want to represent themselves. And then in the third week, they decorate it with alkaline, non-toxic paint. And then in the following week, the fourth week, they break the object. And they know this is going to happen, they sign up for that. But it's done in a way where each person does that and is held in the group by that experience, because it can be very powerful and very patients very reluctant to do it. And we found particularly the women who have participated breaking something that they've created, that they have seen, they've created something beautiful, and now they need to break it, and that's hard. And then in the fifth week, they repair with non-toxic alkaline glue and use the gold dusting to, you know, I think it's eyeshadow actually that we use to create the effect of the gold. And then in the final week, reflect together upon their experience of going through that. And in a way, it's actually stealing from occupational therapy, where there's this principle of doing with. So it's suitable for patients who may not be particularly verbal, because their participation doesn't require them to say a word. If they just do the process, there is something alchemical that may happen. But of course, we cater for patients who can participate at varying degrees and include a workbook where they can work in a more private space to reflect on their experience that they may not share with the other participants.
That's a really beautiful way of working with that concept. I mean, I love the concept anyway, but you also use a quote in one of your chapters, which was remorse is related to the theme of human redemption and renewal. And so it's ultimately an emotion of hope, despite its darkness and pain. And I think, you know, that really comes through as you speak about those workshops. You can hear that those could be something that could fundamentally be very deep, but end with something that's very uplifting.
Yes, so the feedback that we've had from patients about their experience of doing kintsugi is, and actually Sycamore Tree as well, is that people who have broken things, relationships or bodies, their own and other people's, they actually don't believe that repair is possible. There is a fundamental hopelessness or sense of nihilism underneath what then continues often to drive ongoing behavioral disturbance, because that hopelessness is so deep, so profound. So there is a wish in the process to begin to enable the restoration of hopefulness about what's possible, even in the darkest of places.
Thank you. And so you referred to the Sycamore Tree. I wonder, are there other restorative justice programs running in the UK, and do they all follow similar kinds of processes, or are there common elements to these processes?
Yes, so I think that all of the principles will be very similar. There's varying degrees of length and intensity and varying degrees of peer participation. But other programs that are available are the Forgiveness Project, has a program, I think, called Restore. And then also, interestingly, a South African initiative called Silence the Violence, from a charity that is called Kulisa, that was started in South Africa, but which is part of the Desmond Tutu Foundation, I think, and which also runs programs in the United Kingdom. So there are other products available.
Thank you.
We've been talking so well that time is passing. We've got a few more questions here that we need to cover, if we may, with you, Gerard. Most people can probably see there are benefits to victims of minor crime getting involved in a process that enables those who have offended against them to realise the impact that they've had But surely it's a big ask to expect victims of much more serious violent crime to want to engage with this process.
Yes, such an important point, question to be framing in the way that you have. So I think the first thing, against coming back to the language, that it, perhaps victims of serious crime wouldn't necessarily be asked to participate, but they would be either offered or invited. And that would be through a process of explaining how, if they are still struggling with the effects of the offence against them, that this may be a way in which to move forward. So the invitation would be really to be doing something for themselves and an understanding of how the process could help. And remarkably, the growing evidence base from randomized controlled trials for restorative justice across three continents is that the initial idea that it might be more beneficial for youth offending is actually turning out to be that it's more beneficial for more serious offences and for older offenders, that people who have had more time to think and prepare for the offence. So statistically, those types of interventions are going to be more rare because it is a very difficult thing to do, to think about meeting or having contact with someone in the case of a serious offence. But the evidence is that when it happens, it is very, very powerful, very liberating for both sides of that conflict. But it takes a lot more preparation. So for the most serious offences, you might prepare for 6 months to a year. So there is a big investment in time. And in that way, it's similar to therapeutic work in that there is a long process of dialogue about when, as perhaps as a victim explores whether this is something they want to deepen, there may be many meetings with the facilitators to think about where they are, how safe do they feel, what would they need to feel more safe, are they ready, do they need to have therapy first. That's one of the things that, one of the restorative learning points that we've had is that sometimes you pause the restorative process for one or other party to have a therapeutic experience in order for them to be ready to continue restorative work. But there are some very striking examples of when those sorts of serious offences can be adequately prepared for and progressed to very, very meaningful outcomes.
So that's a very helpful reply, Gerard. And just to follow up a bit on those points, though. So you've thought about risk, the possibility of trauma and PTSD being reignited, and what is it like mediating this process? How do you actually go about it and get the right balance between engaging in the process and thinking about the issues and the possibility of overwhelming actually either party with shame and dangerous remorse?
Yes. So, I mean, one of the things that we've found is that not getting to that final point is not failure. In so many therapy, I mean, we know from the evidence base for therapy for offender behavior programs in prison settings that so-called dropouts, those are sometimes likely to increase the risk of reoffending. But actually, in the restorative process, pausing along the way is not necessarily a negative thing or a dropout or a bad outcome. People may have gone as far as they can at that time, and then continue with the work in different ways. But coming to your point about the actual meeting itself and can it be managed, I suppose there's no risk-free encounter. And actually, in order for it to work, there does need to be some conflict. And one of the rules of thumbs of restorative work is that the facilitator shouldn't steal the conflict. That's where the action is. It needs to be able to happen. But also though, you do want to avoid that it's traumatizing conflict, and that a lot of that depends on your preparation for people being able to stop the process, especially the victim to feel under control of the process, and for it to be able to stop at any time. And their trust and confidence in the facilitators, I think, is also another really important point. But what I wouldn't want to lose out on is there's a phrase that's sometimes used for restorative justice work, that it's actually a severe form of justice, for exactly the reason that you're saying, that actually remorse has the potential to be overwhelming for someone who's committed a severe offence. And we, in mental health settings, we need to be particularly alert to that, because many of our patients, their illnesses are because they are paralysed by guilt and remorse. They've got what we might sometimes refer to as being either morbid guilt or toxic shame. And I think in the units that you've worked in therapeutic communities, the men and the women are struggling with that as well. So you do have to be mindful that there is a balance to be contained. And most of the time, that seems to be successful, although, of course, you can't completely regulate a human process.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed your book chapter, Gerard, Restorative Justice Applications in Mental Health Settings. And I think one of the things that you do really nicely in that is you weave together restorative justice and recovery principles. I wondered if you could say a little bit about that today and what recovery means in forensic settings.
So there's been lots of question marks about whether recovery is a useful concept in forensic settings. But what we and the whole community has been working to bring recovery-oriented concepts into forensic settings is recognizing that there's recovery from illness that has to happen, but also recovery from the offense. So what you might call forensic recovery. And in simple terms, what we've learned from recovery processes is that sometimes the professionals need to take a back seat, and people who have been through recovery journeys, their voice needs to be enabled. So the peer voice has been shown to be some of the most effective things that can enable recovery journeys from mental health processes. And I think what I was trying to articulate in that book chapter, in a wonderful collection called Violent States, Creative States, is that it could well be that in offender recovery, the voice of the victim is similar to the voice of the peer in the offender recovery journey, and that we need to perhaps be working harder to enable the voice of victims to be heard in our rehabilitation settings in order for the transformative power of that to also find a place in our institutional settings. So I suppose in kind of simple kind of metaphorical terms, it's really about enabling the voice of the victim as well as the voice of the peer for the double-sided recovery journey to happen, the mental health and offending recovery process to be sort of held in mind. So often in analytic settings, the question's asked about what is the primary task? And that is so often difficult in a forensic mental health setting, because you have to heal in two ways.
Yeah, I think we spoke a little bit earlier, obviously, I think about how in some ways staff can symbolise those victims when they talk about their own vulnerability, their hurt and harm, being harmed in settings. But I know from reading some of the stuff that you've written that, well, it sounds like that you've been involved in services where there's a much more formal process for managing harm between staff and patients. And I wondered if you could say something about how that was and how successful that was or wasn't.
So you're actually right, very difficult thing to do. And right very early in the beginning of implementing the Restorative Justice Project in Sussex, we really benefited from Andy Cook's doctoral research that included interviews with our staff who participated in these types of meetings. And what they told us so clearly was that what was so challenging for their participation is that they were, in order for their voice to be heard, the harm that they experienced to be acknowledged, they also needed to make themselves more vulnerable than they would normally make themselves. So they would need to be able to talk more about how harmed they felt by their experience of conflict in the unit. And that some staff don't want to engage with that. It's not necessarily for everyone. And it might depend upon their relationship to cause them harm, whether they have a stake in that relationship, whether they've got an investment in repair. But that in order for it to be possible for some staff to engage in that, they really have to feel well contained and well held in the process, and to not feel that they're alone with that. You know, they need to feel supported in the process. So it might depend from environment to environment how safe one might feel with the type of disclosure that's often required. And so we try to support staff with thinking about what are their safe disclosures in preparation. So perhaps not to say everything that they might have experienced, but a sample that they feel comfortable with sharing.
It's quite a challenge though, isn't it? In forensic services especially, I think there's a reluctance to acknowledge vulnerability. And I know one of the interview questions we ask everybody, or certainly clinical staff come into work in the services, would you be able to talk about feeling frightened with the patients? And people always kind of like squirm and say, well, I could talk about feeling a bit anxious, but really struggle to own feelings like fear and shame and hurt. I think this kind of like mistaken belief that they're giving away some of their power by doing so. And yet when people start experimenting with owning their vulnerability, I think people see what a game changer it can be. It makes for a dramatically different conversation than, you know, people are frightened to talk about their vulnerability, but they will think nothing of behaving in ways that you wouldn't consider to be professional. So for instance, telling somebody to fuck off, or, you know, becoming really angry with them. And somehow that's okay to be swept away by your anger, but it's not okay to own those pieces of vulnerability. And yet they can really make a massive difference, I think, to people's journey. And for staff as well as prisoners, I think, because I think authenticity enables well-being. And actually, if you're having to muster up anger and punitiveness when actually really what you're feeling is vulnerable, I think there's something about compromising your own integrity as a person there.
Yes, and you're absolutely right that the process does enable a rehumanizing of everyone involved in the encounter. But also, your talking about that in your units is a reminder that there's so much about restorative principles that is already embedded in good mental health practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And which I suppose brings me to the next question of restorative justice just seems to make a lot of sense. So why do you think it hasn't been more popular or caught on and played a more central role in the rehabilitation of offenders?
In a word, I suppose it's fear. Fear of the point that you've just made now about how do we make ourselves vulnerable. But also David's earlier point about the risk of re-traumatizing. The ethical principles of our work first and foremost require that we do no harm. And if you're not confident about an intervention and fear that there's a risk that actually is there a potential harm here, you're going to naturally want to avoid that. But what I would say is, though, that the way in which, first of all, there is a demystification, and that's why I'm so grateful for your podcast as an opportunity to contribute to a demystification process. Having the training and understanding it, so awareness training, in a way a bit like what I said about the restorative city in Hull, starting with a very broad-based staff awareness is a key thing. But then also actually recognizing that there are so many victims in our society who are not properly attended to, whose needs have not been attended to. We invest a lot of money in treating patients in mental health settings, less money in prison settings, but nevertheless, someone in prison will get much more resource than what their victim will get in the community. And that being braver may be a way in which to recognize that actually our work in our institutional settings could reach out beyond those walls in order to also enable healing in communities. But it does require some bravery.
There's a very powerful vision there. I think, again, along that kind of same sort of theme, it was interesting to read in one of your chapters that you'd read Tony Ward's critique of restorative justice as suffering from the absence of emotion. And I suppose to me, this seems to be quite a key problem with how we've approached offending more generally, with decades of reliance upon cognitively driven programmes, rather than realising the huge impact that our emotions or even our other senses play in our behaviour. How do we overcome this resistance to engaging with our work more emotionally? And is that a fair expectation of staff?
Yes, gosh, such another really important theme. So I think that the move towards trauma-informed care is going to drive this for us. It's going to be really, really helpful in enabling a more emotion-centered a way of thinking about recovery and rehabilitation. But also what you said about the sensory experience, the way in which, you to coin a phrase, the body keeps score, that trauma-focused care helps us to focus on trauma being located in our bodies as well, and in our the way in which our bodies articulate our emotional reactions, and the fact that we aren't just traumatized minds, but that expresses itself through our physiology, that trauma-informed care helps us to bring that together. And the way in which we're trying to articulate that in South London and Maudsley is to think that a trauma-informed service is also a harm-aware service, because they are two sides of a coin. Where there is trauma, there is harm, and to try to attend to both in the way in which we conceptualise what we do.
Yeah, I think that's another very powerful point. It seems so often that prisons function to keep the staff safe whilst the prisoners are there, rather than recognising that there's a job to do to prevent somebody who's still dangerous being returned to society. And in order to do that job of reducing risk, it means the staff in the buildings needing to be brave enough to engage with their own vulnerability.
And feel supported enough.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Because that's, of course, the difficulty that prison officers will have is how they shield their vulnerability in the organisational setting, and how we conceptualise that, and that they don't get anything like the type of support that you get in a mental health setting, staff support, I mean.
Yes, and you have to feel safe to be able to be vulnerable. You have to be safe to do that.
Thanks very much, Gerard. So just to end up, as you'll know from the previous podcasts that you may have listened to, or at least from the blurb around them, we are trying to find things which provide opportunities for people to develop resilience and creativity and well-being, both for themselves as individuals and within the institutions in which they're working. And we're aware that for both staff and for residents of these settings, the work can be very challenging indeed. So we were wondering if you could point us in any direction about how you nourish yourself, how you look after yourself. Is there any kind of book or music or activity that you could suggest or recommend?
I think I want to go with an activity, because I think that it's important to have spaces in which you're not trying to simply replenish yourself intellectually, mm-hmm. but that there is a sense of an activity. And I was trying to think you know, about how, what, you know, how to, because it'd be really helpful to that you'd ask me to have some thought of what that might be. But I think in the end, I suppose I came down with the idea of an activity perhaps that you haven't done before, and which challenges you to challenge yourself, you know, whether it's taking up a hobby or learning a new sport, learning a language or an instrument. You know, I think it's being outside of one's comfort zone in order to explore perhaps the territory that we've talked about now, safety and unsafety, and to just find ways in which to be both replenished but also challenged to think about one's way of being in the world in through new eyes.
Yeah, I can heartily agree with that. I mean, I think that's why David and I are doing this podcast, actually. It's a way to do something new that's stretching and challenging and brings you outside your comfort zone, but hopefully you grow. And it really has been stretching of us, I think, in terms of skills. Thank you very much. That was brilliant. Really, really thought-provoking discussion.
Yep, terrific.
Thank you very much for inviting me to contribute and for platforming restorative justice work in our settings.
That was really excellent, Gerard. I think people are going to really enjoy that. It was a really thought-provoking conversation. Really, really good.
And thank you for your preparation.
I really enjoyed that conversation. That was so so thought-provoking, but also I felt quite moved. You could really sense Gerard's passion and commitment to restorative justice principle. That really seemed like part of his identity and integrity as a person. Really, really enjoyable.
Yeah, he's very dedicated and committed to the work that he does. And I love the way that he introduced himself and gave us the context of his upbringing in South Africa and the social context of that time and how he wears that now. And of course, it makes absolute sense that he's developed this very powerful interest in restorative justice.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.